Welcome to the El Arpa podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk. Season 5 is no more. Welcome to the rebirth, the renaissance, Season 6 of the...
El Arpa Podcast.
El Arpa Media Podcast.
We never say El Arpa Media, we say El Arpa Podcast.
Sponsored, produced, written and directed by El Arpa.
Media.
Yeah, you're catching on. So thank you so much for bearing with us on this hiatus. I hope it's been as tough for you as it has been for us. We have missed you so much, dear listener. Welcome back from your holidays, Mary.
And welcome back, you too.
But we will be discussing things about the holiday because I've been reading about the history of dance, right? So I think I'll be able to
get... And rituals.
And rituals as well. So I think I'll be able to get your input on that as well. Also, Frank McCourt, author of Angela's Ashes, Tiz, right? And Teacher Man as well. Those three books, only those three books, will be featuring... in the second part of the podcast. So stay tuned for that. You know what the tour guide taught me in Frank McCourt's house?
You're going to tell me.
I will tell you. If your brother wins the Pulitzer Prize, rush to write a book as soon as possible. Because that's what his brother Malachy did. Malachy McCourt also wrote a book, which I never knew about until I went to the museum. And also it's like a memoir of Limerick as well. So, and also it's called A Monk Swimming. Yeah, so a monk, like the guy with the bald hair.
Yeah.
You know, and for example, and also the holy man. And he, right, called it a monk swimming because, like, when he was saying the prayer, Virgin Mary, Hail Mary, like, Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord be with thee, blessed art thou amongst women. When he was a child, he thought it was like a monk swimming.
I love those things because they always happen when we're little. And there's like that character, Pocoyo, that...
oh, yes.
The Spanish cartoon for babies. And it's also... Its name also comes from that. From like when the kids or the producers were were going to bed and then they were praying. And they said this little prayer that we all used to say as kids. And it just... It was meant to be as Jesus. You know?
Yeah.
Let me be as Jesus kind of thing. But then they understood like little me, poco yo.
Ah, okay.
Which is what they were saying. It was meant to be Jesus, you are little, como yo, like me.
Ah, okay.
But then they kept saying poco yo.
It's like a it's like a sacrilegious version of misheard lyrics.
Yes, it is, yeah. You could. But that happens all the time, isn't it? Like, there's a lot of things like that when we're little and they're quite charming, I think.
They definitely are very charming because also when you're saying a prayer, you don't really fully understand when you're a kid.
You just repeat it.
Yeah, by rote, which is also kind of a problem, I think, in... well, we have our Leaving Cert, which is like the bachillerato in Ireland. People are complaining that it has to be revamped because they're just learning kind of like by rote and by heart, and it's just kind of very methodical but very boring. But in prayers, though, that probably incantation, that chanting... is probably very important because it gets into that state of I don't know,
the
oneness.
Mantra.
The mantra, that's exactly it.
Repeating.
And I've taught you a little bit off air about the mantra and its place in hip hop, but we'll keep that off air.
You're gonna sing for us.
That's in part three. We're gonna finish every podcast in season 6 with a freestyle rap. I'm on the mic today. Next week will be DJ Mary's turn or Snoop Madra.
Send your suggestions for topics.
The Guardian Football Weekly did that actually, and Barry Glendening had to read like various lyrics like in a monotone.
Were they okay?
One of the songs was like My Milkshake Brings the Boys to the Yard. Damn right.
Okay.
It's better than yours. Quality song. So well, that's part one. Welcome back. You're looking well after the holidays.
So are you,
Little Miss Brazil. So we'll see you and we'll talk to you more like in part two. Welcome to part two of the show, Mary. Here's where we talk about things. So, Frank McCourt, you learned English not only with Father Ted, as established in previous episodes, nerds of the show will remember that reference,
yeah.
But also you learned it by listening to an audiobook, and more of that in part three, by the way, of Frank McCourt's Angela's Ashes. You said to me off air, you really... I'm going to slow down, Mike. I'm speaking too fast. I'm rusty after being away for 2 weeks. I'm flying through.
You're speaking to Irish.
I'm speaking to... I haven't lost my Irish speed of talking.
It always happens to you when you come back.
Yes. Speaking of Angela's Ashes, you listened to it on audiobook and really enjoyed it.
I understand you, you know. You don't have to talk like a robot.
But why... Well, obviously, it's a great book. But can you expand more on why you enjoyed it? Particularly when you're, like, learning English as well. So maybe that played a factor as well.
Well, I remember, I mean, I can picture it now, to be honest. I just remember, like, I used to listen to it before going to bed, and sometimes I used to fall asleep because it was a little bit difficult. But I really enjoyed, like, the way he read it, because, well, not all the authors read their own books, you know, but in this case he read it. And it was nice because you could tell that it was his own story.
Well, it's also as well... before it became a book, it was a show in New York called Blackguards, and that's an Irish word for, like, a blackguard, you're blackguarding me, which is a way of, like, you're a bullshitter, basically. Is the Irish word for that. So it began life as a stage show. Like, him and his brother, I think, were acting in it. So I guess it's rooted in spoken word and performance, and that comes through, I think, particularly in the audiobook, obviously, because he's speaking it as well. But in the way it's written as well, it's very maybe conversational.
I think so. And I think another thing that I liked was that, I mean, I knew nothing about what he was talking about before reading the book. I mean, I can't remember how old I was, but probably like 18, 19. So I hadn't really like read that much about, that period of history and so on. So I really enjoyed it because he was like... It was very easy to picture the things that he was talking about and the places. And for me, that's quite unusual because normally I find it quite difficult to... I don't really picture like full places. I just get like a few ideas, but I focus more on the words, not so much on like... I don't need to imagine the whole thing with all sorts of details. But I think for me, the sign of a good book is like a book that gives enough details for somebody who's not very good at picturing things to be able to get a feel of the surroundings where the action is taking place, you know?
Well, we've spoken in other podcasts as well about growing up in Leon, dirt poor, based on a book I've been given. So it's kind of part of the genre, I think, of tough childhoods, no? But you really connected with the story because did you feel as also... It was universal?
I thought it was, yeah, I mean, one of the things, it is really funny at some point. I mean, as much as, like, it's tragic, it's actually, like, quite funny as well.
It's hilarious. It's full of, like, killer lines. I have a selection here. So we mentioned, did we mention part one or part three? Because, you know, by now we always do part one and part three together, but a monk swimming.
Yes,
Is that part one? Well, if you haven't heard it,
I mean, that's part three.
We
have to stop doing it.
Well, for example, young Frank says, "In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Toast." That's one of the lines. Also, this like the movie, I think it does a very good job of replicating the rhythm of the book and the humor of the book as well. Because in the movie as well, you can there's a scene where Angela McCourt, the mother, of course, shows a painting of Jesus to the young boy. He says, "That's the baby Jesus, and if you ever need anything, you should pray to him." And then young Malachi, who's Frank's brother, says, "Could you tell Jesus that we're hungry?" And then young Frank says, "Shut up," for example. So maybe it's better when you read it. There's another one here as well. This is like the very famous opening line of the movie. "When I look back on my childhood, I wonder how my brothers and I managed to survive at all. It was, of course, a miserable childhood. The happy childhood is hardly worth telling. Worse than the ordinary miserable childhood is the miserable Irish childhood. And worse still is a miserable Irish Catholic childhood." So that's very sobering. Opening to the book, and it's true, I think, because we had a tour guide in the museum, and he was saying that he actually had us tone down a lot of things from the stage play Blackguards, because not in terms of of filth or things like that, which normally would have to happen if you're publishing a book, perhaps, but in how much he disliked Limerick. So I don't think he was a very happy camper when he was living there. Though the family, though, apparently are in constant contact with the museum. They come over maybe once or twice a year. And now, of course, there's probably a bit more affection between the family and the city.
As part of the story, you know, there's no point in, like, you know, sanitizing that.
There's no point in sanitizing it, no. But I think it's an interesting book because, like, we just said the opening lines there. At the end of Anxious Ashes, the book, he's on the ship to America, like in Brooklyn, which you mentioned in our podcast as well. Like, they took the ship to America, and one character or another, well, another person says that the Frank is in America, the best country in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the start of the second book, Tiz. Well, Tiz is the title for Tiz, and that's also the answer he gives. It is the best place in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And also there's a brief aside, there's also a guy who became obsessed with Frank McCourt in the 90s who hated the portrayal of Limerick, which can happen a lot, actually, where people get very sensitive about how negatively it's portrayed. So he wrote Ashes, which was like his account of Anxious Ashes, and then Tiz in Me Arse, because he said, like, was it his follow-up book? Because, like, the idea was, like, going to America was the best country in the world.
Mm.
Well, this guy who was upset with Frank McCourt's depiction of their home city, like, you know, a lot of people went to America, or it's the best country in the world, tis in me arse, which obviously in Limerick parlance or Irish parlance means no, it's not.
Only in Irish parlance.
Oh, yeah, and maybe in other words as well. Maybe they say that in French as well, I don't know. But, like, basically, he wasn't too impressed, but he was a bit of a weirdo anyway, that guy who wrote those books. But it is, before we get into, like, the tour itself, which has, like, interesting stories as well, but it is an interesting idea that, obviously, like, he was born in New York, Frank was, and then he moved to Limerick, and he moved back to New York then. So, in a way, it's not as simple as an Irishman going to America and kind of finding himself. In a way, he's very much going home again, you know, even though he's two homes. But this idea, and you've been reading this book as well, so I gave you the book Irish on the Inside, where he talks about this kind of perhaps sometimes dangerous idea of the American dream and America being the greatest country on earth. And that's a refrain that you'll hear a lot of politicians on both sides of the divide using as well in modern conversations and speeches, and it's not particularly a very helpful one, perhaps. But he discusses, doesn't he, in Irish on the Inside, where, like, immigrants are told this idea that it is the best country in the world, and it kind of sanitizes the immigrant experience, because in a lot of, well, official sources, perhaps, immigrants come over, make a life for themselves, and everything's gravy. But in reality, like, a lot of Irish immigrants, Italian immigrants, and other immigrants from other countries didn't have the best of times sometimes in America. So the idea that it's the best country in the world and everything's magically fixed by going to America fits into a particular narrative of the United States and its place in the world. That I think is a bit irresponsible. Not irresponsible. I think for Frank, it was true. So, that's his personal account. But to kind of extrapolate along broader lines, then I think it's probably a bit more complicated to say that it's, you know, it's best place for everybody. But that's an aside anyway. So before I kind of delve into more of the museum itself and what's contained there, and there will be very specific links to America as well, obviously, that we'll explore. That I think would be quite interesting. Apart from this experience with the audiobook of Frank McCourt, has it filled any other parts? Have you gone back to it, or have you explored more of his life?
No, only through, like, what you told me. I think every so often, like, it crops up, and it's just nice to have a reminder of the book, because I would really like to revisit it, because obviously when I read it, I didn't know anything about the subject, and now I have a lot more background knowledge, so it would be interesting to see, like, how it compares. But I'm sure I would find that just as funny. And then the other thing that I was telling you earlier was about, like, how just today I came across a quote saying that you're never too old to publish your first book, and he actually published his first book when he was 66.
That's very true, yeah.
So he kind of, like, keeps, I think it keeps cropping up in places. you know, through the years, so it's a good reminder.
Well, it's that's a very beautiful thing, because even in Ireland as well, Brendan Gleeson is a world famous actor now, or maybe you wouldn't recognize him on the street, depending on what country you're in, but he's appeared in everything from Braveheart to Harry Potter and all these big blockbusters. And he started, like, he left a life of teaching and started acting when he was in his 30s, so it's never too late to kind of pursue the things that you want to pursue. In terms of Frank McCourt as well, he grew up in a time when you were so poor, either you became a musician or you became a writer. And he chose to become a writer. So, and he always, there's a quote attributed to him as well, where it's like, I love the idea that they can't touch what's in your mind. Which is a very beautiful thing, because it's something applicable to any situation. If you're in prison, a political prisoner in another country, or if you're being tortured, or if you're being discriminated against because of your gender, or your religious beliefs, or whatever, you know, it's also true that they can't touch what's in your head. So it's a very universal, beautiful concept. But his history of writing goes back a long way, because he used to take the wallpaper from the house and take it to school so he could write, because if he knew if he didn't take it, that someone would maybe tear it down if it was falling down already and make a fire out of it. And one story was that he was writing in the school, and his schoolmaster came in and asked, like, boy, what are you doing? And he's like, well, I'm writing the history of Ireland, sir. Mm-hmm. And the teacher said, and where did you start? The Garden of Eden, sir. So it was a history of Ireland taken in the Garden of Eden, and probably 1916 as well. So it's obvious like that writing was very important for him, and he felt very sick as well on the day of his communion. And he his normal doctor wasn't sick. You probably remember this from the book as well, that he his normal doctor wasn't around. Another doctor came who was smelling a whiskey and said he'd be fine. But it turns out he had typhoid, which is a slum disease. Mm-hmm. He got taken to a hospital. Run by nuns, but he kind of struck up with a relationship with a girl there, and they were swapping homes at night time, I think, or sneaking between the different wards, because obviously the boys and girls were segregated, and also as well the segregation based on the type of illness that you had as well. So writing was a very important part of his life, and something that was actively encouraged by a couple of teachers in his school. One teacher in particular who was very compassionate with the boys. He said, like, you know, be who you want to be, kind of thing. And he was teaching them about America, because he knew a lot of them would end up there anyway. And also teaching them things like state capitals and rivers in America. And also encouraged, you know, the writers in the class to keep writing, because he really wanted to nourish their young imaginations, and also reinforce the idea that, like, you know, you might be poor, you mightn't have any food to eat. And this is like a paraphrasing what he actually said, but, you know, you have your brain, you have your mind, you have your imagination, you know. And there's some gorgeous, like, apart from funny lines in the book as well, there are some gorgeous lines as well, because Frank McCourt said he discovered Shakespeare, and when he read it, it was like jewels in his mouth, the poetry of the language. So obviously for him, you know, the lyricism of Shakespeare really, really spoke to him. And speaking of being poor, there's also an anecdote about his class year, where one of the boys, the priest found shoes in the bin, but they're kind of very put together shoes, very badly made shoes, you know. And the St. Vincent de Paul, which is a charity institution, is actually a building near the museum, and they actually ended up giving shoes to all the boys in the school eventually. But at the time, not everybody came to school with shoes, and the teacher said, look, not everybody has shoes, so if you have them, you wear them. That's basically what it is. So like, a lot of these boys as well were coming from great poverty and didn't have much in the way of resources, but Frank obviously had his imagination and his books and his stories. And speaking of poverty, like, that also obviously marked him a lot as well, because after he finished primary education, he tried to get in with the Christian Brothers secondary school education, but they didn't want to have him because, you know, he wasn't of a certain stock. He wasn't part of the well-to-do set in Limerick City at the time. So I think this idea of, like, you know, these ideas of inequality, poverty, but also the love of the written word, very present for him from a very young age. And I think the museum did a great job of bringing that to life and telling stories about who he was, you know, and mm-hmm. the kind of person that, and all the other people that helped shape him as well. So I don't know, would you like to, well, I have more to say, but before I continue on a rant, does this kind of museum tickle your fancy?
Yes, definitely. Well, I think, I don't know, that just like having like someone's house for the sake of someone's house, it might not always necessarily be a great idea, but when it's about, you know, a person, a writer that has focused a lot on that particular place, even if it's in a negative way, or, you know, describing like hardship or whatever, I think it's really significant. And it's funny when you were talking about the shoes, because it was reminding me of the book that I'm reading now, which is by a journalist called Richard Kapuscinski. and the book is like Travels with Herodotus. And just as you were talking about the shoes and the value of the shoes, it's something that like really, really struck me too, because he was also saying about how, you know, he was like really, when he was young, he was really poor as well. He had a tough upbringing, and even if it was really cold, like he never had shoes. And then the first time he was sent away to cover international news as a journalist, he was sent to India, and then he felt a kind of like sense of brotherhood with people in India because they didn't wear shoes either. So although he didn't understand them and he didn't understand the country or the language, he kind of like felt close to them because of that common thing of not being able to afford shoes.
That's very interesting, because there's two things there. I remember during the Irish famine, and that is part of the story as well today in today's podcast. Like, I think Choctaw Indians, yes, it was Choctaw, they sent over food from their lands to Ireland, and obviously there's an international solidarity of poor people, because again, they weren't well-to-do either. And also, as I said in previous podcasts, Irish national identity has been based on the idea they've been a colony, so naturally, a lot of what they've done in foreign policy terms and how they've conceived their own identity or our identity as a nation has been based on the idea that we have something in solid, you know, in common with those countries as well. So I think it's a very interesting kind of phenomenon. But even in a class I was doing on Skype recently, I was talking about inequality with my student, preparing him for an exam, and he told me about a study that showed that in areas where everybody's unequal, or not unequal, where everybody's poor, there's very little crime actually in the area. But when there's a huge difference between people in that community, that's when you see crime, for example. So I think it's interesting, yeah, when people often measure each other against other people, and sometimes there's resentment, which can be very justified, obviously. You know, when you see what people who have, and when you are definitely a have-not, by the other side as well, when you encounter people in your same position, how you can feel really, really in tune with them, you know? So it's a very kind of rich story, you know, that people can explore internationally.
Yes.
Which might explain as well Frank's fascination with America, apart from being born there, of course, but the idea of the American dream was that people could overcome these things together, and it was open to everybody, so everybody had equality of opportunity. So even if you didn't come from backgrounds that had no shoes, everybody was kind of equal in that sense as well. So maybe there's something like in the ether, in this kind of abstract cloud that was also pulling him towards America in a sense as well, based on this commonality of backgrounds. I don't know. But that's an interesting aside as well. We must talk about that book as well. So that's what struck you about the museum part so far then, no?
Yeah, well, it's just because, you know, the way you're describing, it's a very local theme, but it's also about a person that talks about, you know, themes that are universal or that can be extrapolated. So,
well, there's local characters that I think you could find like in a Dickens novel or anywhere else, because he got several jobs. One was for a woman who a lot of people in the city owed money to, and when she died, he just took her ledger of accounts and threw it into the river. So he basically freed a lot of people in Limerick from debt with that action. And you have other stories, other characters of, like, when he was getting his first drink, I think he was 15 or 16, and his uncle put him on the bar in the pub and said, "Listen, my boy or my nephew or my cousin, I can't remember the exact relation, but he said, I'm going to buy him his first drink," in the whole pub, like, "Well, hey, woohoo." So there's so many like rich characters that you could find in any great story, you know, like the local loudmouth, the family member who's a bit of a character who gives you your first beer. The kind of stone cold woman that or person that people owe money to, and when she's gone, they're freed by an act of kindness, you know, surprising, you know, you wouldn't expect a boy who's working for her to throw the book into the river, you know. So you have this commonality of stuff, but like also as well, like, it's interesting because it's in his house, but it doesn't seem to be, it's not supported by Limerick County Council. They mentioned that they're in a state of grace in terms of like, oh, new owners have taken over the building. So they don't know if they're going to be there in the future, which is very, I'm not going to go into the ins and outs of it because I don't know what they are. The museum has basically been put together by a woman who actually met, but I didn't know she was the owner until afterwards, so all out of her own pocket. And there's some interesting things there and some good stories. One was, like, you know, I mean, like I said, I mentioned to you, like, this one black feather there that was found in his bed, in his bedroom the morning after he died, which is like completely random. But like the bowl from which Angela's ashes were actually distributed into the river, yeah. which inspired Frank to write the book, is there, and his little urn as well with Frank's ashes. So he's there as well, and it's revealed very dramatically and very very well by the tour guide as well as flourish in his routine. So if you are in Limerick, go and see it, you know, because it seems like something that should be supported by the Irish Tourist Board or some kind of official body. And you mentioned as well, like in Dublin, there's this thing on Twitter about, why is it?
It's like a folklore project, you know. It's about like some slums in Dublin. It talks particularly about the beginning of the 20th century, but it just focuses on the poorest areas of Dublin and how they've been abandoned, but also, delves into these stories of like real people and the relationship between the people there and how they lived. So it's very interesting because it's just accounts of those areas like developing and having their own character, even if they were completely like left aside, you know. So
yeah, because like, you know, in Limerick you had those things as well, because where he was living is actually a nice Georgian area, so you do see nice houses. Of course, anybody familiar with slums will know that a lot of those slums were formed of previously nice houses where people were put into one room. But you know, the evolution of the city, slum dwellings, working class areas, of which Frank McCourt was definitely a product, because they talk about in the museum as well, and also in the book how they used to burn kerosene lamps or animal fat, or if they're like giving a bath to the boys, if you had like 7 children, the oldest goes first and the youngest basically washes and bathes in dirty water of his sibling. So you know, it wasn't like very nice, or you know, outdoor toilet as well, as the tour guide kept saying, they dreaded outdoor toilet. So I don't know, I don't know what's going on there, if why they're not a similar project in Limerick. So I won't say too much about it because I don't know why there isn't, but hopefully, I don't know, the museum will be preserved and maybe something could be done. I think it could be interesting to explore those things in Limerick as well, because it does sound like a very nice project in Dublin. Speaking of America as well, there's some other things there in the museum that are interesting. There's one account written by an American woman who was very close to Frank McCourt in his later years, and she mentions how in America, to go back to the idea of the American dream, that you pull yourself up by your bootstraps, basically. He was giving a reading of his book, and she said, it's a bird there, Jesus. But anyway, she said like she kind of said, like in the middle of the reading, or in the question and answer section, you know, why didn't your mother just get a job? If she's so poor, why didn't you just get a job? And apparently, by Eric, on Frank McCourt, got furious. He's like, have you ever lost, like, several children and had to go out and get work? You know, it's not that easy. Which I think was an interesting kind of cultural clash as well.
Yeah.
Other funny stories as well of America. I think he was doing the routine blackguards in America, and his mother's in the audience, and they're doing a routine about one of the uncles, and she stood up and said, that's not the way it was. And all the people in the audience were like, Is this part of the show? I don't know. But like, the mother as well is an interesting character, because like, she was a flapper. She was a dancer in America, and she had a very beautiful dress that she wore when she went over there and danced in. And she kept in the house in Limerick. And I think Frank McCourt and his brother and his friends, they took it out, discovered it, and cut strips off it. It was a red dress because they made little hearts and put it on there and their shirt pin, and the tour guide said, and we never know if Angela actually ever found out what happened to her dress. So, you know, there's a lot of stories of like other boys being boys as well. So yeah, like if you go into the museum, you'd be taken upstairs first. There's two rooms. One's like a kind of kitchen area where you see picture the Sacred Heart. There's a bedroom where you can see like one of the toys given to Frank McCourt. Also like two beds where you have to use like army jackets to cover yourself, and obviously they'll be covered in fleas as well. They didn't have blankets, they're so poor, so they used army jackets to keep themselves warm at night, even though it didn't really do much for them. And then when you go downstairs, that's where most of the archive material is, including Frank himself, or a little bit of him, like you've a replica of a schoolroom, and you'll get all the stories from the tour guide about Frank. So that's where the meat and bones of the tour is. So as I said, the tour guide was very nice, I can't remember his name, but he gave us a great tour. And it's a great museum, it's a nice museum, it's a nice story, and I think it's been put together with a lot of care and attention and a lot of passion, so fair play to the people involved in that. So I think there's something you want to ask me, no? Obviously I told you before about the American on the tour, no?
Yes.
There's an American boy there, he's in his 20s, Yeah, that's the one I was trying.
Yeah, right. I remember now.
Find me for. Yeah, so he's there with his mother, who was a teacher, and he was I can't remember why the famine came up, but it did, and he started laughing about the Irish people like having enough food in the country, but they're exporting it to pay their landlords, and how that was so stupid, and how he was laughing so much.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't understand, because even if, you know, even if that was a remark, I still don't understand why he was laughing.
And neither do I.
I don't know what's funny about it.
But you said you went to the famine memorial in Boston, which I've actually been to, and there are some factual errors in that. And tour guides will actually got his facts wrong about the famine as well. So, but anyway, luckily I was there, so I stepped in.
Save the day, super E.
Yeah, so I kind of firmly but politely...
that's what you call it.
Went through the facts. I won't go through what I said, but you know the story anyway. No, it was all actually very polite and done in good humour. But I think it's important to step in there, because I think it's, you know, the paddies are too stupid to feed themselves is a wrong idea to have with a famine. So, and we've covered on previous podcasts as well. But that's just an aside. Funny, it is funny. Mostly. at least it was. I was either crying or laughing. I can't remember. But moving on to happier things for the last part of part two of the podcast, dancing and rituals. So my voice is gone. So you've been dancing the old Bollywood, the wood of Bali. So, you know, like, have you learned anything about like great cultural things that have come together in Bollywood? It's been taken from other cultures, or it has some kind of, what are the ritualistic aspects of the dances that you've done in your career as a Bollywood ballerina?
Your career. One of my many careers, because every podcast you say I have a different career. A woman of many talents, apparently.
A jill of all trades.
Master of none. For sure. No, well, actually, it's funny that you mentioned that, because a couple of days ago,
Wait, see how I set you up?
Yeah, I know, yeah, I have to learn how to do that, yes, okay.
Apologies if you heard me drinking water as well. Anyway, continue.
Yes, okay, so I was watching, now you're probably going to laugh, but it's like a travel channel that they have, like, travels on, like, train. And I really like it, like, it's like, I don't know if it was Michael Palin or, like, you know, this Portillo guy that was playing in the backside, but, I mean, the documentaries are, it's nice to see, like, all the different...
trains.
Yeah, no, but you know, like,
no, don't worry. Look, after after we record this, right? I knew you got into train spotting, so I brought a flask of tea, some hand sandwiches. We go to Atocha, write down some registration numbers. Yeah,
no, but actually, like, they're quite, I think they're from the 90s, but they're quite like nice documentaries. I watch every so often, but anyway, so like,
is this before or after you do bingo?
Yeah, with a cup of tea.
Is that why you're so big about your holidays? I went north and south. You actually went to the train stations.
Yeah.
The last 2 weeks.
Yeah. No, I never moved. I just stayed in my house watching traveling channel.
Well, you actually can buy a train simulator for the PlayStation.
Do you want me to tell you about...
Okay. Carry on.
Okay. So, yeah. Shut up. He went to India. He was traveling across India,
yeah.
And he came across these people that danced Bhangra, which is a dance that I'm quite familiar with, because it's usually taught in the same places, or, you know, in the same circles as Bollywood, even though it is completely different. So obviously, in his, you know, Western ignorance, he says, oh, I'd only heard of Bollywood. And then these people say, well, actually, like, Bollywood kind of, like, originated from Bhangra, right? Now they're completely two different things, because, well, Bollywood is obviously based in on, the film industry. And now it's kind of like a melting pot of a lot of different dances and different cultures. But Bhangra originated in, like... the moves done by
did it originate in Bangladesh?
No.
Carry on.
Anybody, just bring a drum, you know, drum roll. Wow, that was amazing. we can like edit these afterwards. The drum roll, which, as a matter of fact, they do have drums. Like, drums play a very important part. So I think this is probably why you said this.
No, actually,
see?
No.
See how I did it to you now.
Anyway, yeah, story. Okay. Yeah.
It's called a dol. Dol is the type of drum that they use. And it's all based, which is what I was trying to say, the movements that they made when they were...
So like dancing in Lunas and stuff as well. So they did a dance to celebrate the harvest time in Ireland, so it has a clear connection.
Yes, definitely.
And also, of course, a character in the play as a priest, the brother, and he comes back from Africa completely enthralled with their rituals and their dancing and everything as well. So
yes,
there's a lot of cross-cultural connections here.
Yes, it's very similar. So basically the moves, you know, just... And then actually when you see it being danced, it's quite like a frenetic dance. It's quite fast and very like joyful, doing the harvest and putting the crops and all those things. They work the that dance into the whole. Well, it only part of it. I think it at first it like, you know, mimicked the actions of living like in the fields and having this agricultural atmosphere, and then also like they work the dancing to it so that it kind of turned into a bit of a ritual as well, and it sort of ties in with what you were saying about dancing as ritual. And I think even in like the ancient world, I think it's like it is documented, because the same as when we talked about the ancient instruments, when we went to the exhibition about the ancient instruments, certain things that are like key for society, such as, you know, going to war or the harvest or planting the crops, those are things that structure time for the society. So like dance is kind of like a way of supporting those activities.
Well, also as well in the history of joy, a history of collective joy, which is a book about, well, dancing as a ritual, basically, that she talks about, it was Barbara something. But you can Google the book anyway on Amazon, A History of Collective Joy. Very good book. She's an anthropologist. She's written another book as well on a similar theme. This is the second book. Well, about dancing and culture and how it was a marker between times of war and peace. It's actually explored in the book A History of Collective Joy, which is a fascinating account of the ritualization of dancing, how it's always had a ritualistic aspect in human society across different cultures. But she makes the point, the author does, about how it was very common in society, but then when they became more militarized and worried about defense of the lands, in places like Egypt and other cultures, dancing became less of a ritual, while military training became more prominent, or focus in society became on was turned onto other things, for example. So what's also interesting for me from that book, which I would recommend people reading, is the Greeks were a bit more into the whole, you know, religions and dancing and kind of expressing this kind of spirituality, while the Romans were a bit more functional. A bit more about into administration, a bit drier, and didn't really go along too much with the kind of Greek religions, and they tolerated them for a little bit and to certain extents, but there's also cases where they kind of clamped down on these kind of Greek dances because they didn't think they were good for society, basically. And which is very interesting, because Romans, you know, they did dominate a lot of cultures, but they did also adopt things that they liked. They just didn't happen to like parts of Greek culture that involved ritualistic dancing. Now, what's also kind of interesting there is because you have like the Romans playing the role of the colonizer, or the conqueror. And if you look at kind of European nations in the 19th centuries, they kind of play that role as well when viewing the dances of indigenous people, you know, in Latin America and Africa as well. For the most part, they were appalled because they associated it with sexuality, which actually wasn't the case. It was just kind of fevered, I don't know, psychosis or hang-ups that the Europeans had. In most cases, there wasn't a sexual component to it. It was just a way of keeping people together. Because after all, it also had a hunting aspect. If you got taught people to move in the same way in certain patterns, also you could get the whole community to act as one when hunting bigger beasts, because the bigger beasts saw all these people as kind of one giant enemy then as well. So it might have had that function as well. But, you know, the book does kind of explore the kind of Western attitudes and how complicated Western attitudes were towards the ritual of dance, because, you know, a lot of ways they were appalled, but in sometimes with certain explorers, they didn't take the time of day to go to the festivities because they didn't think it was worth their interest. Other European explorers of both genders were kind of like, sometimes were, you know, despite themselves, moved by the power of multiple voices as one, multiple movements as one. The music, you know, stirring things very deeply as well, of course, in your body, you know, because it's that's what it's designed to do as well. Sometimes very ancient, because you find very crude drawings of like from prehistory of this function being performed as well. What's also interesting as well, she kind of explores, you know, Freud, for example, didn't really believe much in it. He thought it was very frightful. He felt the only thing that you could do to enjoy yourself was to have a picnic, read a book, or spend some time in the arms of your lover. And Dora makes the point as well, like, that, you know, in psychology, you find a lot of articles about depression, but you don't really find a lot about happiness. And it seemed like a lot of, you know, Western people at the time couldn't really get their idea behind this idea, get their heads around this idea of, like, collective joy, because for them, they were so buttoned down, and perhaps the societies were so structured that, you know, this kind of unbridled joy, they just didn't understand it, because their societies were a little bit suffocating. Now, of course, you do have things like Carnival, which I think Freud disapproved of as well, and other elites would disapprove of as well, but other rich people didn't, and they could mix, rub shoulders with poor people. It was a way, there's two kind of functions here. The poor people could kind of, like, have mad joy and really have fun, which a lot of people also thought was necessary to prevent, like, uprisings, because you need to give them one outlet, maybe once a year or twice a year, to get rid of all these things and kind of keep them satiated. But also for the rich people as well, to escape their stuffy confines as well. So, you know, even though this kind of neurosis, this kind of, like, contradictory attitude that a lot of Westerners had towards these ritualistic dances, you know, despite themselves, they had, like, similar outlets sometimes in their cultures, and despite their biases and imperialistic and maybe Western-centric ideology, you know, they kind of fell in love with it as well, but they're working very hard to kind of put it down and to say it had no value to society. And that's also what's interesting about the book, not only exploring how common it was across timelines and cultures, but also very specific Western reactions to it as well. And it goes up all the way to, you know, rock concerts and football stadia as well, and World Cup matches, that kind of thing. So there's more to talk about as well, more to explore. But we can keep that also for another podcast. So that's me, at least, for part two.
That's us for part two.
Well, on part three. Welcome to part three, otherwise known as the rap section.
Mm-hmm.
So, Murray, we've come here to the end of the first episode of season six. We've more irons... First episode of season six. So we have more irons in the fire than just this podcast, even though this is what we love to do. We are going to be in audiobook territory as well. And if you haven't done it already, you can find our app on the Android store. Also, I watched a few clips of Trainspotting 2 T2 over the weekends, and that whole theme is kind of running through the movie. It's a very beautiful theme, and it's done very well. It's kind of like, you know, things changing and these kind of abstract things, but I also felt very really in the moments. But it's also a very beautifully put together movie. I think technically it's a gorgeous movie in terms of camera angles and how Danny Boyle kind of visually sets up his movies. And it's funny because Marina Hyde in The Guardian, right, she was talking about how when she asks politicians about their favorite movie, they very often give the impression that they don't actually have time to watch movies. And then once Nigel Farage was so stumped by her question, like, he just kept saying, like, I don't know. And she's like, kept giving, like, suggestions, until finally she said,
yeah,
Love Actually. She's like, yes, yes, something English.
Oh dear me. Okay.
So Richard Curtis is the favorite. Well, he's the favorite director possibly of Nigel Farage. But what was I thinking? Like, because I mentioned, like, before about Psycho as well, off air as well. I mean, I was trying to answer this question as well. How would you say what your favorite movie is? If you want visuals, you have to say Danny Boyle. If it's another movie that really speaks to you in a certain way at a certain time, you could choose another one. German movies of Daniel Brühl. Big fan of his, obviously. Half Catalan, half German as well. All-round legend. So I think it's difficult to say what the best movie ever is, but I think definitely you can say for certain styles or whatever, you can choose, like, either a great director or a great writer or a great kind of sequence of movies. I mean, if you're looking
script.
For... Or a script as well, yeah. But, like, cinematography, you know, people have worked with, like, Steven Spielberg, for example, have put together some really good-looking movies. Ken Loach, who we said before, big fans of him on this podcast as well. So there's so many different types of directors and movies. I don't know if politicians are genuinely scared of, like, saying what their favorite movie is, because if they do, maybe the director will, like, disown them. Cause
it,
like,
reminds me of, like, you know, when they ask Gordon Brown about his favorite group, and he said the Arctic Monkeys, and then they were kind of like, I'm not sure they really wanted to be associated to him, but I think people were just making jokes that he thought that was like the cool thing to like at the time.
Yeah, well, there's other politicians as well who like, or I think David Cameron actually, his favorite football team changed like 3 or 4 times. I think currently it's Aston Villa. But before it was another team. So, but I think, well, obviously, really Clinton loved the saxophone. But I think Tony Blair, I was going to say Tony O'Brien, which is a guy I went to school with.
Hi,
Tony. So Tony Blair, yeah, so he also was famous for kind of like dropping in cultural things. He loved being photographed with Oasis. And like, I like Noel Gallagher, but Noel Gallagher, I think, got taken for a ride a little bit there because, you know, he's obviously being used as a PR stunt, like Cool Britannia and all that kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Who else? Who are those guys? Manic Street Preachers.
Oh,
Jones or Fidel Castro as well. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they were shown around Cuba by him, and I think they're very odd overall to be in his presence. But I think what you said about Gordon Brown is why I was going at as well. They're scared to say what their favourite movies are because, like, the people associated with it go, we don't want you liking this movie.
Exactly.
So yeah, but Psycho as well. I mentioned to you off air that it was filmed in a special frame, or millimeters, 50mm, I think, to replicate what the human eye can see. And because it's about a voyeur and a guy looking at things, it's supposed to replicate that feeling of seeing things with your own eyes on screen as well. So it's kind of.
I think it's the anniversary now.
I think it's the anniversary. Yeah, it's a very good movie. Perkins, who plays Norman Bates, did a great performance with that role, so fair play to you, Perkins. So yeah, so just check us out. You can find us on Patreon as well if you want to support us. And also hello to our new listeners. We've been blown away by the diversity and spread of the podcast. All people all over the world tuning in, so thanks very much,
including unknown places
and also unknown places that could be a little bit more known than Audioboom and other platforms can recognize. But before we do go, you have to plug also as well where you can support us directly by listening to the podcast. So obviously you can find us on any platform, and we're very grateful if you do listen to us on any platform, but in particular if you listen on
Radio Public.
What happens?
It means that you support us in doing what we do, and also it's a nice platform because it's free and it just, you know, lets podcasters kind of like promote things just for the sake of radio.
Yeah, I mean,
so it's quite democratic.
And I'm not biased, I mean, but I think the layout is gorgeous.
It is quite nice. It's quite easy to, you know, you can listen on the website or you can just download the app.
That is very true, yes. Yeah. So if you listen to us, it will generate money for us as well. Not very much, but but every little bit helps and we always appreciate it. So that is it. That is the end of the first episode of Season 6 podcast, The Return to Form. So thank you so much, and we'll be talking to you next week on next week's episode. Mary?
Bye.
I couldn't say it better myself. The Alarpa Podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk.